It's 7 o'clock. Do you know where your freedom is? Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Sparkwood and 21, the No Ship Network podcast on the Showtime television series Twin Peaks. This is a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
If you like what you hear, head on over to noship.net where you can find all of the other podcasts we do. If you like horror, we have Penny Dreadful, Ash vs. Evil Dead. If you like historical, we have Vikings and Spartacus and The Shadowcast, our podcast on American Gods. Contact us through Gmail and leave us a review on iTunes. Also, check out the TV Time app. It lets you keep track of all your favorite shows as well as participate in a community of like-minded fans. I'm actually on it. Believe it or not, I'm on no other social media but this. No Ship Steve. Drop me a line. Tell me something. I don't know.
Yeah, so if you want to reach any of us individually, talk about anything that we've said on this podcast, you can do that through the TV Time app. I'm Empath on the TV Time app. You're No Ship Steve, and Paul, you are...
Paul at noship.net.
And also, you can reach us through our Gmail at noshipnetwork@gmail.com. All right, we are discussing Twin Peaks, The Return, Part 12, titled Let's Rock. This was written by David Lynch and Mark Frost and directed by David Lynch. Okay, so we start out at the Hotel Mayfair with Gordon, Tammy, and Albert. And they are seated in the sitting room of the hotel suite of their room, possibly, which Tammy's got red drapes behind her. It's an interesting hotel room setup, actually, because there's also another set of drapes that Diane's going to enter through. It's just thematically convenient for these characters.
For sure, especially being red flowing drapes.
Yeah. So they're drinking wine that Gordon has brought on the plane from his own personal cellar. And he's actually scanning the room with that red device. So that's, is showing that this is for testing for wires, making sure that they're not bugged.
So now we know. So it's confirmed. The mystery solved.
Which we've had somebody point out that he actually scanned Tammy with that early on. So anyway, Albert specifically starts talking to Tammy to induct her into the Blue Rose Task Force, which is a task force they have between the FBI and the Air Force, which took over from the Project Blue Book that was first initiated back in 1952 and then was shut down in 1970. He claims it was shut down as a massive cover-up. And also, Project Blue Book was preceded by Project Sign. So Project Blue Book was not the first UFO government investigation organization.
So typical of the government to have an organization that produces so much information that they decide to shut it down and claim the reason for it is, well, there's no compelling evidence that any of this is real. Besides the specimens that we have in tanks and besides the reams and reams of paperwork and all of that other documentation, aside from that, it's not real. So we're just going to go ahead and shut it down.
And the hindsight claims for the reason why it was ever even created in the first place was because there were so many sightings that were happening around that time that in order to assuage the public concern, they created this organization so they can debunk and debunk and debunk all these sightings that were happening. And once the sightings went down in number, that's when they closed it up, supposedly. But then there's, apparently have been some other secret organizations that have arisen to take over, which I don't know much about that. So that's why I say supposedly. I mean, I believe that they do exist just because people do these things.
Right.
As hobbies. I mean, I know people who are very much invested in Bigfoot. So apparently Tammy's a badass, an intellectual badass. She's had all these achievements throughout all the schooling she has. So they've had their eye on her for a while.
This is, I like that they included that because we were all kind of wondering that, not just our podcast, but I think the fan community in general was wondering, why is she around? What is she adding to the mix? It better not just be a pretty face and a set of long legs and high heels kind of thing. And it's not. She was the top of her class wherever she went. She's shown potential since the very beginning, and she deserves a spot amongst the greats. I mean, that list of names, Gordon Cole, Philip Jeffries, Chet Desmond, Albert Rosenfield, Tammy Preston now, and Special Agent Dale Cooper. I mean, the best of the best of the best, even though some of them have been missing for a little bit. So what was interesting to me about this was Chet Desmond gets mentioned. Yeah. So he's real. He exists. There were some interesting theories that have been put out there about him being Cooper's alter dream ego and things like that, which I always thought were neat. But now we know, I guess he's a real guy and he's just been gone, just like Philip Jeffries has. And so Tammy Preston gets to join the gang, and it was pretty cool. I mean, I got emotionally jazzed about it. You know, when she got psyched up, I got psyched up. It was a great way to open the episode.
And so we also learned that the Blue Rose got its name from a woman's dying last breath, where she said Blue Rose. After we saw the vortex, the Diane podcast actually posted an image of that vortex on Twitter and described it as a blue rose.
Oh, that's really cool.
So maybe this woman had seen a gateway, mm-hmm. and that was the last thing she saw before dying, possibly.
Yeah, that's a really cool take on it.
So the line, these answers could not be reached except by an alternate path. Is that literally an alternate path through vortexes and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, it works. It works nice and neat, doesn't it?
They were pretty familiar with what they saw in wherever mm-hmm. Ruth Davenport's body was. Whatever that was, whatever they saw, they weren't shocked and awed by it. It was just like, do you think there's one in there? So mm-hmm. I think it's literal. I think they've been dealing with these things for a while.
I like Gordon's concern towards Albert because, as you've already mentioned, Steve, but we've already got Chet missing. Philip Jeffries is missing. Mm-hmm. Cooper is missing. So I think this is the first hint of a theme that's happening throughout this episode, even though they're not actually father and son, but it is a fatherly concern. And we have a couple of father-son moments throughout this episode. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so now Gordon, who had turned up his hearing aid, turns it down. He gets a text from Diane. She's on her way in, and soon she's actually entering in to the room through those red drapes that I've mentioned already. And I swear the sound is exactly like it was in the lodge, like the way the drape sounds when she opens it.
Right.
Like the backwards kind of sound.
There's mm-hmm. just something about the shifting of the drapes. And then, you know, she's wearing the same shirt that she was wearing when she confronted Mr. C.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
Which it doesn't necessarily mean anything because they are traveling. So she probably only has like a few changes of clothes. But we do see her later on this episode wearing a different shirt, wearing the shirt that she was wearing when she got the coordinates from the mm-hmm. picture. So it does make me question, when did this scene happen exactly? But I did go back and look, and Tammy's blouse is different. So the blouse that Tammy's wearing in this scene is not the same blouse she was wearing in the Mr. C scene.
Okay, cool. I was getting worried there.
Just so we're clear.
Yeah. And the one later, she could have gone to bed because she went to the bar after it was kind of closed. So maybe she just threw something on and went to go get a drink, right? Screw it.
Well, we see her at the bar twice. So she's still got the red shirt on. That's right. And then she's got her leopard print jacket over that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so she sits down at the table and Albert brings her over a bottle, but he does not make her a drink when she says she likes it on the rocks. He just leaves it up to her to do that.
Yeah.
I love that. Me too. He was like, hey, I did you a solid by getting you. We're all drinking this fine Bordeaux over here, and you need to have your vodka. That's fine, or whatever it is she drinks. But I'm not.
And he shows her the bottle like it's a wine. Like, ooh, look at this vintage of a vodka.
So they deputize Diane on a temporary basis, and she asks what's in it for her. And Albert says a little bit of cash, not much, and maybe some satisfaction in finding out what happened to your friend Cooper. She's quiet for a minute, and when we've got the sound that like picks up, she says, "Let's rock." That creeped me out. And all it is Diane saying, "Let's rock," in a normal voice, really. And you've got the sound design that comes from Fire Walk With Me.
Yeah.
It's amazing what associations will, the power of associations. And I thought it was kind of cool where when she says, "Let's rock," you got that tone or whatever you want to call that sound that happens. And it stops right when Gordon raps his knuckles on the wood. And I think that plays into the whole acoustic resonance thing, because when you have like a tuning fork that's vibrating and then you touch it to something, it'll stop it, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's good. I like that. He was just like, "You're done. Stop."
Now, do you think she knew about what was painted on the windshield and that's what she said it? Just like a little bit of a dig also?
Well, they had mentioned earlier on in the season how she's somewhat familiar with Blue Rose case, but I don't know how much she is. Yeah. But I imagine she would be because Cooper, who was investigating that, he's the one who saw the "Let's Rock." I imagine he would have recorded it into his handheld tape recorder, and she would have got that information.
Seems like it's in bad taste too for her to say that, because I mean Chet Desmond, one of the very few Blue Rose Task Force people, disappears, and there's red writing on his windshield that says "Let's Rock," and mm-hmm. so she's using that as a way to say "Let's sally forth and get this done." Mm-hmm. It's kind of like
maybe her corruption started back then, getting those tapes.
I'm still not 100% on her corruption. I know I might be the last person to hang out. I feel like maybe she's doing all this to find out what really happened to Coop. And then knowing that there's somebody that looks like Coop out there, that she can't trust anybody. So she's this guarded person that's doing all these nefarious things. And in her own right is trying to find the real Agent Cooper. You know, it's just me. It's just a little piece of hope I have left for her.
I understand where you're coming from. I'm not on the same page with that one. Unfortunately, I can't co-sign it because I feel like she is, like, at the beginning when we were hypothesizing, well, maybe mm-hmm. she's just doing this, or maybe she's part of another group. It's like I've kind of moved away from that into she's bad camp. And something about what she did in this episode when she said "Let's Rock" cemented it for me.
I know,
but we'll
I'm
see.
On a lonely
we'll see.
Island.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I still have so many different takes on different moments between characters because he didn't want to make her drink for her. I almost feel like that's an act in front of Gordon. Like maybe they're working together, or
interesting.
Albert and Diane, you know, or and the behavior between Albert and Gordon later. Sometimes I feel like there's something more passing between them that is not communicating to us directly. Like some sort of code. But then I'm like, well, no, Albert's just suspicious of Gordon for some reason. It's so hard to be sure about what's happening on the screen.
Yeah. With those two, I just feel like he's tired of like his shenanigans. So he just kind of stands there like, hurry up. I don't know.
Yeah, I get that take sometimes too.
For sure.
His stoicism is admirable, especially giving what we know his witty tongue is capable of. He just kind
exactly.
of keeps it in his mouth most of the time.
With this particular scene with Diane, we're meant to think on the surface that they're fooling her into thinking that they trust her.
Definitely. Yeah.
So now we get a quick scene of Jerry Horn. He's still running around. Like he's not actually in the trees, but I would say he's still lost because I think he's just got a break from the trees a little bit here.
I take it as he's finally on his way home. Because the way that the mountains look in a few of these episodes, you see the clouds and everything kind of rolling in over the trees. And when he ran out of the woods, it seemed to me like he was running from the mountain and the forest itself. You know what I mean? Like he's finally in a direction. I would put money that he's back in Twin Peaks next week. Because it did. It finally looked like he had gotten his bearing. He got out of the woods and can finally like get somewhere safe, you know, and the way we've described everything bad coming in to Twin Peaks, you know, from this like centralized bad area that he's feeling it from, it felt like he was finally getting out. Like, oh, I'm finally like on my way instead of fighting all these crazy things that are around me that might be in his head. It seemed like it like an escape, like, oh, thank goodness he's not yelling at his foot or losing things, or it felt a little freeing to me.
Oh, well, that would be good for Jerry if you're correct, but I have a feeling he's going to be lost until the last episode. And how long has he been out there? It's only ever been daylight anytime we've seen him. We haven't gotten any kind of like idea if he's been there overnight.
I think that he was getting away, kind of like Paul said, and that he finds his car, and he's the person who almost hits that guy Trick that goes to the roadhouse.
Oh, that would be great.
At the end of the episode.
That's good.
That's kind of what I was thinking, because at first I was thinking maybe he had a run-in with Richard Horn, who was trying to leave, get
that's
out of Dodge
thought,
fast,
too.
But then I was like, he should already be gone at this point.
Yeah.
You know, unless he had some other business to take care of, get out of Dodge, right? So I figured that was Jerry Horn finally found his car, and then just was barreling towards the Great Northern or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So now we have Sarah Palmer at the local grocery, and she's buying ingredients to make herself what looks like to be a Bloody Mary. So I wonder if she's trying to combine nutrition and alcohol at once and just like two birds, one stone thing going on there.
I mean, it sounds great, right? Vitamins and booze. Like, what can go wrong?
tomatoes in it. That's good for you, right? Lycopene. This is this is a good thing.
Three bottles and she was reaching for more. Like, I know there's one hiding. Oh, crap.
So she gets up to the register and she's startled by the jerky and has this conversation about what type is it? Is it smoked? Were you here when they arrived? The way she phrased those questions reminded me of Mrs. Tremond asking about the creamed corn on her plate when Donna showed up for Meals on Wheels.
You know, I kind of felt for the kids behind the counter when she starts kind of going off, because I think I would have probably had the same reaction, like, do I need to call a doctor?
Yeah.
Or it's made the same way as the other jerky. It's just turkey. You know, it's a little comical, but she did such a good part. She did such a good job acting that crazy, you know, especially when she starts talking about there's men coming. It was like, you know, it was really well done. It was really well done considering everything else we know. That could be anybody at this point, you know. So it was a cool scene.
When she's talking about the jerky and she asks if it's smoked and then she says, men are coming. This is a direct reference to Woodsman in my mind.
Yeah.
And
oh, nice.
I think there's Woodsman at her house later when Hawk is there. And that's what we hear tinkling around.
Something but like that. Yep.
There's something. We'll get to that scene when we get to it. But that's who I think she's referencing specifically is the Woodsman. They're coming. And when she asks, were you here when they arrived? I don't know if she's necessarily talking about the jerky. I think she's already slipped into panic mode and she's asking about the Woodsman or whoever else it may be that is coming to Twin Peaks. And she's asking, like, were you here when they got here, when they arrived? And
so do you think possibly she has one of those frog bug things inside of her and that's how they're staying connected? Or maybe one of the Woodsmen have inhabited her? Or
a lot of people had speculated that the little girl in New Mexico was a young Sarah Palmer, and this has in their minds added some confirmation towards that theory. I don't personally subscribe to that just yet, but I can see how it would, because it's almost like something takes over and starts operating her, telling her to get out. But I also like the idea maybe like Laura is somehow helping her out too. Maybe Laura's in there, but.
Now, if the Woodsman took Bob out of Mr. C, could they have possibly stuck it in her?
That crossed my mind when Hawk comes over in the next scene that we get with her, because of the way how different she is acting when she leaves the store and how she is whenever he comes to the door, like her facial expressions, her tone of voice, how much she is in control of herself and just able to be so like passing off what happened and like, oh, that's just something in the kitchen. That's nothing in the kitchen unless you got a dog in there that's rooting through your recycle bin. You know, that's not just something in the kitchen. But at the time, I felt like she was having a full-on panic attack. And I think that's a way to handle it is to pull yourself out of the situation and become third person and command yourself to do certain things to get you to like a safe place, either physically or in your mind, you know, to just to kind of circumvent that anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's interesting idea. So you think because Paul, you just suggested that possibly it's Bob in her, so that the woodsmen we saw in the vortex that looked like they were on the staircase are the same woodsmen that pulled Bob out of Mr. C and now have placed it in Sarah Palmer. And that's why she's behaving this way.
Yeah. It's a possibility. I mean, definitely. You know, I just kind of threw it out there. It's the way that she acts that it kind of reminds me of her husband. You know, he does like the family. So why not put him somewhere that he's familiar with, I should say, you know?
Well, if that's the case, Laura needs to come and save Sarah because that woman's been through enough. For sure.
Yeah. She's had her share. Leave her alone.
Yeah. Jerks.
So now we're at Fat Trout Trailer. And Carl tells Kriskel not to sell any more blood. This Kriskel guy has been helping out around the trailer park quite a bit. And so Carl wants to give back in return. And it disturbs him that somebody has to give blood to eat.
Mm-hmm. I think this scene is here to illustrate how good of a guy Carl actually is. Mm-hmm. And also this goes a little bit further to establish him as somebody who is going to be almost like a field marshal in the fight against the big bad whenever we get to it. Because you had him in the previous part where he was on the phone with Maggie, the police dispatcher, and talking to her and stuff like that. So it's kind of like they're establishing these little things. Like he's kind of like a leader. He cares for people. He's this and that. And I might be reading too much into it. He might just be being a good guy who's taking care of the people in his park because he kind of sees himself as their shepherd or something. But that's the takeaway for me.
I like that.
Yeah, I see that he's like the shining. He is. He's the beacon of light in Twin Peaks right now. You know what I mean? But it also makes me worry for him because that they're putting so much into how much of an amazing guy he is and this and that. It would be devastating to lose him in a terrible fashion. You know what I mean? To where maybe he comes across something first or anything like that. I feel like they're setting us up for him to get it. You know what I mean? It would be like the last bit of good in Twin Peaks is getting snuffed out, you know?
As long as he goes out doing something significant for the good side, I'd be okay with it. And I think his character would be okay with it.
Oh, because, yeah, for you know, sure.
He's seen enough.
I just want his whistle.
So next we have a very quick scene of Dougie and Sonny Jim playing catch.
Now, I noticed upon rewatch that there's no action in this episode. There's nothing that drives the story forward physically. It's a series of conversations between people is what it is. And the only two actual things of action you see are Jerry running through the field and Sonny Jim making Dougie play ball.
Plain throw.
What's that?
Plain throw.
Playing throw. Yeah, catch. Yes. Yeah. Not catch, oh, just yeah, you're throw.
Right. It is just throw.
And I also have to apologize to everybody whose hopes I may have gotten up by thinking that, you know, after eating the cherry pie at the end of the last part that Dale Cooper was going to be back in effect. I was wrong. Womp, womp, womp. Dougie's still here. And this was, I think, since he's been in there, the least amount that we've seen of Dougie and or Mr. C in an episode. It was really just almost a cameo appearance for Kyle MacLachlan in this episode, and it's a testament to how good and how much fun this return is that it didn't matter to me because I was still so enraptured by everything else that was going on.
Yeah, we haven't seen Mr. C in a few episodes.
Where is he going to turn up? It's got to be shocking since we haven't seen his journey, you know? Whenever he does pop up, it's going to be like a moment, you know, a breathtaking moment because they're not giving us anything. So when he pops up, it's got to be somewhere like in the shadows in Dougie's house. I think it's going to be Vegas. He turns up before Twin Peaks because of the text message. So I'm on edge of my – I'm like on the edge of my seat to find out where Mr. C's at. You know, that's the one thing that's really starting to concern me.
Yeah, and also the prints that the Fusco brothers are going to run are going to also, I think, bring the FBI there before they go to Twin Peaks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah, because he's going to need help if Mr. C and his gang show up. He's not going to be able to handle that on his own.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that would be bad news.
Well, probably the next time we see Dougie, he's probably going to be fighting off Anthony Sinclair because it didn't work with the Mitchum brothers. And so Duncan Todd had told him, like, it's either the Mitchum brothers kill him or you do.
Oh, shit.
Well, I can see Anthony Sinclair the next time we see him floating face down somewhere because the Mitchum brothers probably took care of him because he made it a point to come to them and say,
oh, yeah,
Douglas Jones is your enemy. You have an enemy in Douglas Jones. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be like, no. Mr. Dougie Jones, Mr. Jackpots is our good friend and buddy. Mm-hmm. And it is incumbent upon us as good friends and buddies to dispose of his enemies. So,
yeah,
it's a possibility. Just throwing that out there.
I like it.
You think the Mitchum brothers will end up in Twin Peaks with Dougie?
Why not? His own little army? It'll even the playing field out a little bit. Maybe even give him the edge.
And candy, too. You know?
I would love a scene of the Mitchum brothers eating cherry pie in the double R.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't like that? Come on. Seriously. That would be so much fun just to have them be awesome. Just going off about how good the pie is and slurping down coffee.
Mm-hmm. Because if you think about it, Mr. C's shown several different people that work with him. So they're going to need, if they all show up, plus the woodsmen, they're going to need some bodies to take bullets so our favorite characters don't get it. You know, so they're going to need some Mitchum brothers and other people there.
The next scene, Hawk visits Sarah Palmer. And we see a quick moment of the fan whooshing. So that sets the eerie tone, even though we already had it set with the first time we saw Sarah Palmer in this episode.
And it was in black and white, too, wasn't it? The fan?
I think it was in shadow.
Shadow, yeah, okay.
I don't know, you could be right. I got the impression that it was just mostly dark in that room, very little light.
It looked dark behind her when she opens the door, so that works perfectly.
the ceiling fan has always been a harbinger of Bob in that household and his power, the electricity, the nastiness. And we get a little shot of it. Then we get a bigger shot of it. Then we get Sarah Palmer going to the door to talk to Hawk. And she has that changed demeanor. And you hear the clinking in the background. So if Paul's theory is right, that ceiling fan just supports it. Because I don't think it's thrown in there just to be like, hey, it's a callback to the ceiling fan. Remember that, everybody? There's significance to it.
Right. Because Leland as Bob would be the one that would flip that shit on to hide noises.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And being, yeah, because that would be the perfect thing to do it, because being in the Pacific Northwest like that, you don't have 9 months out of the year where you've got a noisy air conditioner unit running.
And she did such an amazing job acting. She was kind of terrifying in her own right. You know, like, good gracious.
When she grits her teeth.
Yeah, the teeth and the stare she kind of gives off. It's like, it was hard to kind of like look at her a little bit because she did just exude this weird just persona. It was really well done. She should be in like a legitimate horror movie. I think she'd do a great job because she's scary.
She's a great actress, partly because of skill, but also because she has this really mobile face. Mm-hmm. I mean, even her scalp moves, and that can like add to this like sort of like if she's like showing surprise or even more complex emotions than that.
Yeah,
she can add to it in really interesting ways, just moving her scalp.
Right.
So when she grits her teeth, she says, "It's a goddamn bad story, isn't it, Hawk?"
She's commenting on everything that's happened to her and her family, and how she, even after all of these years of possibly relative quiet, we don't know what's going on in that house, which gave me chills to see again, by the way, you know, looking up at it. It's almost like seeing the house from Nightmare on Elm Street or something again. You get that feeling like, uh-oh. What about Hawk's reaction? Because he's like, do you think he knows something? Because he says, basically, if you need anything, any kind of help at all,
yes,
call me.
With emphasis.
Yeah, because you figure it's you can't just barge into someone's house, you know. So if she gave just a little inclination that there was something wrong right then, he would have been able to go inside, investigate the house. It has something to do with the law, I think, right there, to where it's like you're not invited in. So he gives her like the best out ever. All you have to do is say, my toilet's backed up, can you help me? And I'll go inside and take care of whatever's going on. Anything. I dropped a quarter and can't pick it up. Anything. So that's why he gave that open, wide open statement. Plus, I mean, he genuinely cares later too if she needs it, but I took it as that.
Well, maybe he suspected there was more going on than meets the eye. Mm-hmm. You hear the sound in the background, so maybe there was like some sort of underlying meaning to what they were actually saying. Like, just give me the signal, some sort of signal.
Yeah. Wink twice.
Yeah.
If you need me to come in with my gun out.
Oh, yeah.
So this is cool. It's not cool that Miriam's in the hospital, okay? But but the camera pans upper body, which made me immediately recall Ronette. And there's purple roses that are right next to her on the nightstand there. And the last time we actually saw Ronette Pulaski, who's is actually known as the American Girl now, was in the purple place.
Oh, so. Nice.
And there's also the added, I think a lot of people were probably thinking as well, too, when it panned up that this could have possibly been Audrey, because there's been a lot of fan speculation that she never came out of the coma after what happened to her with the explosion. Yeah. It was a cool scene for me because there's been a lot of fan speculation that Audrey didn't come out of the blast intact, really, and healthy. And, you know, we get that theory debunked at the end of this episode in a really cool scene. But by that time in the episode, when you're first watching it, you don't know. So you're thinking, oh, this could be Audrey because, you know, so much has happened with her family already that you're just like kind of waiting for that other high heel to drop and say, where is she? So it was neat the way they play with your expectations.
Yeah. And the way they actually stoke some of these theories and are aware of what the possible theories could be and play to those, which is amazing.
Yeah. It's like they're second guessing us. Cause I mean, obviously I mentioned it before, all this stuff is filmed and ready to go before we even see scene one, but they know that people are going to start thinking in certain directions and they toy with that a little bit. It's like you're being led.
Yeah, it's genius.
Okay, so now we're back with Diane, and she's at the bar at the Mayfair Hotel, and she receives a text, and she's still wearing the red shirt at this point that we saw her in earlier.
Okay.
She receives a text, and it says, Las Vegas? And she responds, all in caps, they haven't asked yet. So we'll talk more about that when we get to the scene with Albert and Gordon. So now we have Frank Truman visiting Ben Horn to tell him about Richard Horn killing that little boy and assaulting Miriam. And Ben says, that boy has never been right. So I bet that a lot of people are feeling that they're correct about who his father is. Mr. C is starting to certainly look more and more like that.
Plus, he says he never had a father on top of it. So it's like, It really starts to fit.
Yeah, but John Justice Wheeler also is no longer around too. So Audrey and him had sex not long before that bank explosion. So who knows what happened to John Justice Wheeler and his airplane.
The whole idea of Mr. C being the dad is intriguing in the sense it's cool that people figured this out and you put it out there and you're like, oh man, that'd be fucked up. But just the gross factor of that,
no, I know,
just makes my mind just wants to like avoid it, you know, just like slip around it.
So Ben asks after Harry Truman, and he asks this because he mentions how Harry had run-ins with Richard Horn, and each time he had a run-in with him, it got worse and worse. And then he tells Frank that he was going to send Cooper's room key to Harry. But I like how Ben asks more than once, do you think he'll like it? Like he really wants to please Harry Truman.
Right.
Because, this is like illustrating that Ben has come a long way.
Oh, yeah.
From the Ben that we knew from season one.
Definitely. Yeah. The season one Ben would have found a way that, you know, this is his grandson doing this, and it could have been him doing it, and he would have found a way to try to get out from paying that hotel, you know, bill, or that hospital bill. But here he is offering to pay for her stay in intensive care, the operation, and he's asking after the parents of the kid who was hit, you know, so.
So I hope we get a scene where we see Frank give that key to Harry.
Oh, that would be sweet.
Maybe that's, you know, important. Maybe that has some impact on how the events will go forward.
Right.
Maybe it'll be magic.
Please let it happen. Please let it happen.
I know.
Truman leaves and Ben tells Beverly about Richard. He talks about how Richard never had a father. And then he recalls how his father bought him a bike and how he loved that bike. And he tells Beverly to call the hospital and arrange to pay for all of Miriam's medical expenses. Mm-hmm. And then she leaves the room and he's still talking out loud about the bike. I love that bike that my father got for me. And I think maybe this is supposed to help us see the difference between him and Richard in a way, where maybe it's possible for Ben to have a redemption in his whole story arc where somebody like Richard doesn't because of that, not having that connection like Ben had with his father. Like there's something to that.
I think you're right, because I think those family ties are humanizing. Obviously, that seems like a very obvious on the nose type of thing to say. But think about it for a second. If you have all the pieces in place of a at least a decent upbringing where you had parents who you knew cared about you and gave a shit and did stuff for you like that, you can go off and be a bastard, but then when somebody points out that you are being a bastard and you have a change of heart, it's almost like those familial ties give you the psychological tools to bring yourself back to being a decent person if you really desire it enough, so people can change.
Well, yeah, I think there's definitely some commentary about how, like, there's the familial impact, because we had last episode with the shooting that Bobby witnessed with, you've got the father and son. The son had, you know, shot the gun out of the minivan, and they're dressed exactly alike, and that's supposed to mean something. And then you also have Becky and Shelley and what's happening with them as far as, like, the men in their life. You know, it's definitely a theme.
I like it. Dads need to be around. Dirty Steve never had a dad, I bet.
Nope.
That's why he's like how he is.
So now we're back with Gordon and a French woman, and he's telling her about a historical battle. I'm not sure what. I know there's like 75 men that there's a trap and they're going up a hill. And Albert comes in and he says, will you please tell your friend to wait downstairs? And through minutes of coquettish gestures and lipstick and shoe putting on, all that stuff, she eventually leaves the room. But, you know, within all this, she's doing certain things that I wonder if this is a Lil thing, like from Fire Walk With Me, because I didn't really get that idea until when she takes a sip of the wine. I swear Albert looks a little surprised, and then he looks thoughtful. Like that was like some sort of code. And we can't forget that Gordon Cole is in love with Code.
That's true.
it doesn't mean necessarily that that's what's going on, but it did occur to me, and that's what it felt. It totally reminded me of Lil. And then what he says after she leaves the room, which is she's here visiting a friend of her mother's whose daughter has gone missing. The mother owns a turnip farm. I told her to tell the mother that her daughter will turn up eventually. So this is a lot like the conversation that took place in front of Lil when Chet and Sam Stanley were there as well. And Chet had explained in the car to Sam Stanley, well, what was missing? Well, the uncle was missing from the conversation that Chet and Sam had witnessed. But in this one specifically is the father who would also be the farmer, right? Because if the mother owns a turnip farm.
Yes.
And we had a farmer earlier on that Andy was meeting with.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm wondering if that farmer is Billy.
Oh, wow.
And a conversation we just left about missing fathers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. That's what's missing.
Interesting. That's really good.
That her theory is much better than the one that I had. I felt like there was, I got some definite Lil vibes off of this as well because of the way that she was doing certain movements and stuff like that. There had to be some explanation for that. So I'm totally bought into that. But just as I saw this as Gordon Cole being David Lynch. I saw this as the French woman being the show Twin Peaks up until this point. And Albert as us, the audience.
Right.
And yeah, Lynch is directing this very, very beautiful thing to look at that's kind of giving you peeks into things here and there and showing you some stuff that you want to see, but not everything. And then you have Albert as the audience looking on with different
puzzlement.
There's puzzlement, there's attention,
surprise,
there's surprise, there's thoughtfulness, there's all of
that's
the
really
all
good.
Of the things that we're running through too. So it's a little bit of a microcosm of what's going on.
I like that.
You know, so yeah, it's also taking its time to unfold. So, you know, I mean, it from the time that he tells her go down to the bar and I'll call you, I mean, how many minutes go by of this stuff? Usually people just go, all right, I'll see you in a bit, you know, put their shoes on and run down to the bar because they know this guy's got to do his important FBI stuff. But she takes her sweet time.
So, oh, for sure.
So that's where you're getting some of these good reactions out of Albert, because some of it's like he's enjoying it for the most part because it's nice to look at. But then he's kind of going, well, what's going on here and what's up with that? So I feel like he's the stand-in for us. And I can really only take that so far. It's just something that kind of popped into my head. I don't know if it really stands up.
I just thought that Albert knew Gordon was into some kinky stuff. And when he asked her to go, he had seen it before. So he was like, will you tell her to leave, please, so we can talk? And then they were into some like flirty, kinky stuff. And it lasted a little longer. And she ended up just kind of leaving and getting to the door. So when they finally talked, and he's standing there like, you know, just listening to him ramble about whatever else is going on, that he was just like, all right, man, can we finally get to what's at hand? You know, why is she even up here right now? Anyway, there's a huge case going on. So that y'all came up with completely better things than I have thought of. That's fantastic, because I was a little lost on this scene. It's like I could tell something a little was going on with the way she was acting, but I was frustrated. It was like, man, get snap on him a little bit. Get things moving.
We need Frank from Always Sunny in Philadelphia here as our fourth co-host so he can be like, what was happening was pretty clear. The old guy's trying to bang the hot broad and the bald guy is trying to get in front of him.
I definitely think the whole turnip farm thing, that's just so bizarre to even say. So that's definitely
that
code.
Totally felt like code. And when he says her mother had the what was it? The daughter
whose mother, she's visiting a friend of her mother whose daughter is missing.
Yeah, the whole family member code thing. It's her mother's sister's girl. What's missing?
The uncle.
Yeah. So it felt like that same kind of thing, but then it turns into a bad pun. So you're just like, okay. So is this part of the code too? Because Albert really doesn't seem to pick up on it. He's giving him a lot of blank stares. Like he's just kind of done at this point. He's like,
exactly.
I just gave you some important information about the communication between whoever and Diane, and you're giving me jokes that could possibly be code. We don't know.
And like you said earlier about the whole father figure thing, he's giving them information like the amount of languages that are in the world. That's something that my dad would tell me, like, oh, did you know that there's 35 different kinds of insects in my yard right now? Like, okay, Dad, thanks.
I just imagine Albert's heard this a million times from Gordon.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean, when you hang out with friends and coworkers, you hear sometimes repeats on stories and other things. So
oh, yeah.
You definitely heard the 6,000 languages.
Okay, so Gordon asks Albert, what did you want to tell me? And Albert reports about Diane's text, and which is the Las Vegas, and they haven't asked yet. And Gordon says, what do we know that we haven't asked her about? And I think it's obviously the fact that she had told him she will tell him someday what went down between her and Cooper.
So Diane's waiting for him to ask that so she can steer them in the direction of Las Vegas?
Yes. And so, unfortunately, to me, if she did that whole encounter with Mr. C as a way to set this as an act to set the stage so they can get this question asked so they can get them to Las Vegas, that doesn't look good.
But why would they want them in Las Vegas, though?
I have no idea.
See, that's the only thing. Like, why would you want to steer the FBI? Yeah, it could be.
Kill Dougie and the rest of the Blue Rose group that's trying to hunt them all down. I don't know what else to think about it. I mean, there's...
I thought it could have been the ring, but why would she know about the ring? She wasn't even in the autopsy room. So that's that out of the way right there. I just don't know why Mr. C would want him there to muddle the assassination of Dougie Coop. You know what I mean? That would just be... But I can't figure out Mr. C anyway, so I don't even know why I'm trying. So throw that one out, too.
All I know is that the Mitchum brothers are going to throw some monkey wrenches in somebody's game at some point. And it's going to be hilarious.
So I don't know, because... I was trying to think maybe if Mr. C has something in store that he could use, but everything he's been throwing at Dougie so far through Las Vegas just has not panned out. So
yeah.
Seems like he's running out of options.
Yeah, he's going to have to send the Wonder Twins over there for sure to kill him or himself. Because how terrifying would it be if Dougie's walking around the house? Because, you know, Lynch likes... And Frost, like those dark hallways that you just see Mr. C's outline in the shadows down a hallway or something. Oof, be amazing.
And he doesn't see it, you know?
He's just going on with his cookies and coffee or whatever. Oh my God.
So Gordon wants to get back to his fine Bordeaux. Albert asks, what kind is it? And Gordon thinks he says, what time is it? And he says, 11:05. And they stare intently at each other. And again, this can be read in various ways. Each time I watch it, sometimes Albert looks annoyed and I'm done with your mishearing me, but really hearing me bullshit. Or there's something else that's being transpired between them that I'm not capable of understanding because...
Yeah, I think it's frustration. I mean, how many years has he had to work with Gordon? And can you imagine constantly having to repeat yourself or getting the wrong answer? It would just be like, it would wear you down. It would wear you down.
And I thought this is really good acting from David Lynch because you can see that the look he gets in his eyes at the end of this little stare off they're having, he does really look concerned and he reaches his hand up and put his hand on Albert's shoulder and says, Albert, sometimes I really worry about you.
And he's like squeezing his hand over and over.
Mm-hmm. Which we've seen him do before.
I can't remember where though.
Squeeze his shoulder off.
So now we have a quick scene with Hutch and Chantel, and the scene is where they take out the warden. She's not in the mood to torture. She's hungry. And I think Hutch seems disappointed that, and he tries to encourage her. He's like, well, maybe I'll just like shoot him in the legs and you can still go out there and do it. And she doesn't want to do it because she doesn't have time because she's hungry. And I was wondering, maybe he's just depresses him because maybe the magic is gone out of their relationship. And this is something they shared together.
And I have expected her to be like, I need to go to Walmart's and pick some groceries up or something to that effect, the way that they talk to each other. So it kind of cracked me up a little bit.
But it's disturbing though when the warden's son discovers his father and so the son's going to be damaged, the impact of that, seeing that
another father missing.
That's a good point.
As bad of a guy as that guy was, but
but to have Cheetos before you eat Wendy's, I don't know why, but that just grosses me out. Like, that just seems like redundant in the greasiest, like, foulest way ever.
Like, unless you're gonna put the Cheetos on the burger, then I can kind of understand it. I'm kidding
or if you opted out of the French fries and had the Cheetos as your side instead, maybe. But like, to eat a bag of Cheetos and then go get Wendy's is just like, ugh.
Yeah, you're gonna get the GERD.
So now we have a quick scene with Dr. Amp, and I think this is exactly what we've seen before. I couldn't tell if there was anything different, because even the rant towards politicians was the same, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was a lot of retreads here. Everything from his commercial that we've seen before to him saying the fucks are at it again, which I think is probably something he says every night at 7 yeah. o'clock, you know. But the even the scenes with Nadine watching, they make it slightly different by having her say something. But she's sitting in the same spot, surrounded by mostly the same things, looking at the computer screen. So it felt like a I'm kind of hard pressed to see the necessity of it, besides maybe like a little bit of a time filler, you know, between, which I wouldn't think they would need, because the episode clocks in, even with credits, at under an hour. So,
well, do you think it's like something to show that it's a routine every night he goes on at the same time? So maybe at one point it stops.
Well,
and then you know something's kind of kicked off, you know, like something's
yeah.
wrong.
Yeah. I think also maybe actually having Nadine say something and she says that the shovel's working for her. So maybe it has a lot to do with about belief mm-hmm. and things where you put your belief and how that can also have its effect.
That's a much better take than
yeah.
they just needed to fill up 3 minutes. I like that. Right? We'll go with that.
But I also think it's meant to like unprepare you for what's coming next, which is Audrey.
Oh, yeah, that's true, too.
Nothing could have prepared you for that.
I didn't know the right word, but it's like I just remember being like, wait, I think that was all like the same stuff. And so I'm kind of like thinking about that. And then all of a sudden there's Audrey in front of a fireplace.
Misdirection is what it's called.
Yeah.
Misdirection. Get your mind going in one direction and then they give you Audrey.
So this has destroyed quite a few theories, specifically Audrey in a coma. But there are some mm-hmm. people who still believe that, and that this is, you know, like something that's happening within her mind in a coma. But that Audrey is not the billionaire, because there were some people hoping that she was the billionaire, which would have been an interesting and an attractive thing.
Yeah.
This is just one of a few things in this episode. This episode went a long way towards probably like taking a lot of people's theories and kind of going, I guess that's not really what's going to happen, you know, because there's a lot of people who thought a lot of stuff about Chet Desmond, a lot of people who thought a lot of stuff about Audrey. The fact that we're now mentioning the kid being hit by the truck with Sheriff Truman and Ben.
Yeah.
So that kind of there is a little bit of linear time going on in Twin Peaks. So a lot of stuff that people were, you know, thinking is just that that's the thing with Twin Peaks. You just never know, you know, but
I'm still not, the time is still weird. So I'm not quite sure about that yet. But it did have a more, okay,
they recognize
they're following up on stuff actually.
They recognized that kid had gotten hit by the car, because there was a lot of speculation because of the fact that nobody had mentioned it after that it hadn't happened yet in what we were watching currently, and that it was, you know, we had seen like a flash forward and then now we were getting flashbacks and then it was going to kind of go. So anyway, let's get to Audrey.
So, okay, she's standing at the fireplace. She's what we learn to be later is her husband, Charlie. They're staring at each other defiantly, and she's upset because she wants to find Billy. And as the conversation progresses, we learn that Billy is her lover, who she's been sleeping with for some time, and he's been missing for 2 days. But Charlie has a deadline and he is very tired, and he doesn't want to go out and hunt for Billy, is what she's begging him to do, essentially. She's really distressed because she had a dream about Billy the night before and he was bleeding from the nose and the mouth, and she feels that dreams hearken to truth. And then she also mentions that Tina was the last person to see Billy. The more that they talk, Charlie's saying how he wants the best for Audrey. And she says, well, sign the papers then. So she's trying to get, it sounds like, a divorce going, if that's what the papers are regarding. And he wants to run them by his lawyers because they look fishy. And then she threatens to run them by Paul.
You're right. I've been waiting for the papers this whole time.
What are you going to do to Charlie is the question. Why is he afraid to have you come over?
Right.
And he's surprised that she's going against a contract. So I'm not sure what the nature of their marriage may have been to begin with, but it sounds like it was possibly like a transactional relationship. But she's like, yes, I will renege this contract. So I think in his mind, he must know her well enough to go, wow, this is really desperate of her. So that's when he mm-hmm. says, okay, I'll go with you to the roadhouse. He's, I'm so sleepy, but I'll go. And that cracks me up every time I watch it. That's my favorite line of this episode.
So did anybody else get somewhat of a Catherine and Pete vibe off of this?
Yeah, now that you say that, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's even with the way that, you know, now that Sherilyn Fenn is a little bit older and she, the way she's doing her hair and the way she had her coat on and stuff like that, mm-hmm. she doesn't look like Catherine. But I felt like the way that she was berating this guy who, you know, Pete was always seen in her eyes to be smaller in mental stature and social yeah. standing than he actually was. He wasn't a small guy, but this guy is literally small. Mm-hmm. So he's almost like a stand-in for that. So you have the angry woman towering over the small man, not just in perception this time, but in a literal sense this time.
Really good.
And they have him seated. But I don't know if that was intentional, but I got that. It brought to mind Catherine and Pete. Even though I really, really liked Pete and – you know, Charlie, I guess he could grow on you, no pun intended, but he you don't have that soft spot for him because this is the first time you've seen him, you know, so there's yeah. not that emotional connection. He's not the one who found Laura. He's not any of this kind of stuff. He's just mm-hmm. this new character that's introduced in the 12th part of a, you know, 18 part series. So that's, he just is who he is, I guess.
He really wants to negotiate his way out of like leaving the house. So he keeps trying to find ways to not get up from that desk. And so eventually he offers to call Tina, which I guess that wasn't an option when the conversation first started. But now that he's like, wait, I'll go to the roadhouse. Wait. No, I'll call Tina now. Before he calls Tina, though, it's also mentioned that Chuck told Audrey that Tina was the last person to see Billy. And he's like, wait a minute. Chuck stole Billy's truck. And then Billy called the sheriff. And then the sheriff, it sounds like, found his truck that afternoon. And then Billy dropped the charges.
Hmm.
So before he calls Tina, I want to talk about this real quick because if Billy's the farmer that Andy was visiting because of the truck.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay. So, and if Billy's dating Audrey and Richard is Audrey's son, he would
okay.
drop the charges against Richard, wouldn't he? And maybe, yeah. or maybe Richard forced him to. Maybe Richard strong-armed him into dropping the charges. Maybe that's why he had to go back into his place and why he was supposed to meet Andy later because he had to deal with Richard first, but Richard dealt with him. But maybe he was like, I will tell my mother something about you if you don't, yeah. you know. That seems more like Richard's style, right?
Yeah, it does. Oh,
absolutely. Bullying.
But then he ends up maybe killing him or
yeah, because of
knows.
The dream. It all that fits so nicely.
And then like Chuck, Chuck could be Charlie's son and they call him Chuck. He could be named after Charlie. They call him Chuck. And so I don't know.
But who's Tina? That's the question.
I don't know. Where's Linda?
Right.
It's like a Julie Cruz song, you know, Tina till Charlie, Charlie till Paul, Paul till Chuck. So here's my question to you guys about this scene. What the fuck is the nature of their quote-unquote marriage, talking about Audrey and Charlie over here, right? And why does she feel like she can go and say, hey, you're going to stop doing whatever work that you do that provides for this household.
Yeah.
And you're going to help me find my lover that I'm cuckolding you with.
Yeah.
And if you don't, I'm just going to verbally abuse you and call you no balls loser and milk toast and spineless and all this other stuff. It's like, how do those insults even have anything behind them when you're already in bed with somebody else? It's like I don't get
maybe
that.
Her dad cut her off of all the money. So she decided to shack up with this guy. And maybe he's just so lonely that he's like, well, maybe if you stay married to me for a certain amount of time, you'll get X amount of money and you can take care of yourself.
Or maybe she didn't want anything to do with her dad's money anymore. Mm-hmm. Maybe she made the break. And, you know, we don't know. There could be a lot to what's going on between them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just like with Frank Truman's wife, there's more than meets the eye, and we'll eventually get that information, you know, dealt out to us. So at first,
and maybe that's what changes her dad, is that she calls him out on all the stuff that she knew about him. So he's just been trying to be better after all these years to try and get her back.
I can see both. I get that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of like complimenting each other's points with that. She's with this guy, so she doesn't have to mess with the horn money and be part of the dirtiness. But why does she feel it's incumbent upon Charlie to help her go find her lover? That's
because
what
she's
I'm
a badass. She's like, fuck it. It shows you. Well, it shows that she's being serious. Like, fuck it. I need help. You're the only person I can go to, and you're pretty much worthless. I want a divorce. So she's at that point of, I've got nothing to lose except for what I want, and it's out of this. So that's why she's like, I'll just belittle you till I make you. Or you can sign the paper. So you can either sign or you can come with me. Or I'm going to stand here and belittle you for the next hour. How does that feel?
I would have went to bed.
Well, I mean, it just comes back to being just like you were talking about Pete Martell and Catherine Martell, like all these years of marriage that has hardened them towards like certain aspects of their relationship to where they could have unreasonable expectations about certain things like that.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. And Charlie has mink oil on his head.
But we're going to find out, I think. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I'm really interested to find out like that whole scenario. Like, how did that come about? That's some juicy stuff right there.
Oh, yeah.
So Charlie calls Tina as a way to avoid going to the roadhouse. And we can hear his end of the conversation, obviously. And it's possible, very likely, that he's hearing about Richard Horn killing that kid, and Tina asks him not to tell Audrey.
But shouldn't she know?
She should. We don't know the nature of their relationship. We don't know.
Do you
her overall health? You know,
yeah, that's true.
Do you guys honestly think that Tina told Charlie not to tell her, or do you think that he's just drawing out that information and withholding it for dramatic tension for us?
Or he's scared to tell her because of the reaction she's going to have.
Yeah.
Because she's just berated the crap out of him. You know what I mean? So he's just kind of like, let's just go to the roadhouse.
Yeah, because if Tina was the last person to see Billy, that means Billy probably talked to her about what he knew of what happened with his truck.
Mm-hmm. And so he doesn't want to have to go over there and, oh yeah, see, all that works so well together. He just,
So this just opens up such a big old new can of worms that it's almost more worth it for Charlie just to take her to the roadhouse to look for Billy.
Exactly. Exactly.
So now we have a scene with Diane again, and this time she's wearing the same shirt she was wearing when Bill Hastings was killed when they had the meetup back at the detective's office, Detective Mackley's office, with the coffee and donuts. And when she looked over at the photo and saw the coordinates on Ruth Davenport's arm. So this must have been right after that particular meeting. The bar is actually closing. It's interesting to me how she's always pushing boundaries, you know, like sitting in places where people are closing and they're still serving you, or, you know, smoking indoors when you're not supposed to.
Drinking alcohol at inappropriate times or copious amounts of it, you know?
Yes. Being rude.
Being very rude. Yeah, just saying fuck you to people who, you know, are just trying to do the right thing.
So she types in the coordinates that she memorized, where she somehow memorized the numbers on top of the word coordinates plus two, which is pretty awesome.
Yes.
That makes sense now, because I was going to ask you guys, because I think that just kind of went over my head, because when she's typing it into her phone, she's going coordinates. And I'm thinking, is she typing in the word coordinates or the numbers of the I couldn't tell. Like, or was it just supposed to be like a substitute, so we're not knowing what the numbers are?
I could be wrong about that, but that's why I gathered. I know the last two numbers are also smudged.
Right.
So
But she had to have it correct because it comes up with Twin Peaks on her cell phone.
Exactly.
So that can't be wrong.
Which you can't help but imagine Mr. C getting the text back and just kind of putting his hand on his head like, duh. You know,
why did I leave in the first place?
Exactly.
God,
like,
damn it.
Twin Peaks, big ears, oof.
I guess he had to leave Twin Peaks, though, or else he would have had to spend all of the time after that as an FBI agent.
Right.
And there's, you know, not a lot of time to build your criminal empire and be a billionaire. So
exactly.
So speaking of Twin Peaks, we are now at the Roadhouse with a Natalie and an Abby, and they're wondering where Angela is. So we got a whole bunch of more names coming up here. Angela was supposed to show last night, but she didn't. She might be with Clark. Clark and Mary were here two nights ago. Clark's been on Angela for weeks now. He's really spreading it around. She's off her meds now, meaning Angela. So, and they're talking about how she's kind of on the edge. Who wouldn't be losing her mom like that? Mm-hmm. And then Trick comes and sits at the table with them, and he's really freaked out because someone almost ran him off the road, and he said a farmer had to help pull him out, and his right arm, he lifts up to show that it's shaking a little bit.
Like a cat on a hot tin roof. So this booth at the Roadhouse, nothing good happens here, so I'm going to call it the Frank Booth from now on.
Oh, hey-o.
This is the Roadhouse's Frank Booth because it's all crap. You either have Sparkle in the Itchies, or you get sexually assaulted by Richard Horn, or you're talking about your friend's infidelities, or just something's going to go on here. This was probably the table that, you know, Big Ed was sitting at when he got his drink spiked. Mm-hmm. And then punched by, you know, one of the high schoolers.
So do you think that we're getting all these scenes in this booth to see, like, show us how the rest of Twin Peaks is being affected? Like, all these different conversations and different people. It's just to show us just how bad it is there? Because it's never anything really good.
I mean, I was thinking about that because it's like, there's just so much terrible things happening in people's lives. Like, I was even thinking Beverly's home life is shit with her husband. You've got Frank Truman and his wife, there's a lot of tension there. Shelley, Becky, Bobby. I mean, I think all this stuff is almost like a atmospheric tones to kind of get you feeling that tension that is just like constantly mounting.
Yeah.
And I think that's the purpose of seeing that there's no comfort anywhere, really.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I agree with both you guys, what you're saying on that. I feel like it is a way, like Paul was saying, that's a little microcosm that just checks in. It's the temperature gauge on Twin Peaks just to see how fucked up and crazy it is. Because, I mean, you can run down the list of stuff that's happening inside of Twin Peaks. You've got prostitution. You've got murder. You've got
drugs.
Drug running. You've got, like weird interdimensional and crazy beings and stuff like that, none of which was not there in the original series, but now it's just so much sharper. It's so much like more barbed and nasty and disgusting.
It's like commonplace now.
You get the sense like the shit is really about to hit the fan. Like there's this wind up happening. And I mean, especially like they're just talking about these people that we don't know who they are, but like she's off her meds now. Like the potential for something to go down is great.
Yeah.
So it's almost like it's a metaphor for what's going on in the town. The town's off its meds.
It just keeps heightening that sense within you as you watch the show, and I think it's clever. It's coming at it from very different ways, and rather than doing it the same way every time, you just have like a different approach to kind of keep stoking that feeling within the viewer.
And it's just going to keep that slow build until it explodes, I guess. Or until it comes to that boiling point and then everything all starts to happen at once. But I really like the juxtaposition of that kind of like seedy underside negativity with whatever bands they have playing, because the bands are usually playing a pretty mellow kind of jazzy, I don't really know how to describe all the music in one sense, because some of these bands have been very distinct and different from each other, but they all kind of travel in a similar vein where you could kind of see that they're the musical heritage of what Julie Cruz was doing in the Roadhouse scenes has lived on sonically.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they don't sound like her necessarily, but they carry that same kind of vibe.
I should say it was the Chromatics too.
So that would make them the second band to appear twice.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So all in all, it was a really great episode, especially considering, like we mentioned before, that there wasn't any action that was driving it forward. You know, like these last couple of parts had a lot of stuff in there, like just the double R scene alone, you know, with all the stuff that was going on in the shooting afterward and stuff like that. And you have, it seems like here you just had a series of conversations, and then you had Sonny Jim and Dougie Coop playing throw, and then you had Jerry Horn running through a field, and that was it as far as action was concerned. So
yeah,
to to keep the attention like that and to just keep the Twin Peaks vibe going and the smiles on our faces for that 50-something minutes is quite a feat, and they accomplished it. All right, so that concludes our coverage of Part 12, Let's Rock. So join us again. We'll be back in a couple of days to hear what you guys thought of this episode on our feedback podcast.
That's right. So the deadline for feedback at noshipnetwork@gmail.com is 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time this Thursday.
We'll see you on the flip side. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
Très bon.